Good to see you all tonight. Glad you could make it. And like Linda said, like I've been saying too, we'll be talking about the three characteristics this evening. So I'll be starting with the first talk, and then Linda will come in with the talk afterwards. So three characteristics. Impermanence is one of them. Suffering, unsatisfactory is one. And not self. And the Pali terms for these three are anicca, dukkha, and anatta. And these three characteristics are universal qualities of existence. They permeate all aspects of our lives. They are something that we share as humans in this life, regardless of whether we realize it or not. So understanding the three characteristics is not a matter of belief or Buddhist dogma. But rather, it emerges from mindful observation and discernment of this mind-body process and how these characteristics operate in the world. So you might say three characteristics are a bit like gravity. They may not be something we fully understand, but we can get a sense of how they operate in the world, and like gravity, we can see how important it is to have a healthy regard for them. A baby gets this healthy regard by pushing oatmeal off its high chair and sees that connection, ultimately refrains from doing that. So the Buddha talked a lot about the three characteristics. They're interrelated and are very important perspectives in this practice. Ignoring them or denying them creates problems for ourselves and for others. Basically, suffering results from trying to find permanent satisfaction and security in impermanent conditions, including our sense of a substantial permanent self. So that ties the three together, that statement. So understanding how the three manifest in this world gives us a perspective that helps us navigate life with less clinging, less frustration, less disappointment. It's a perspective that leads to less harm and suffering for both ourselves and others. And we begin by practicing to understand, and then with this understanding, we can practice with that understanding. So I'll look at each of these and start out with impermanence or anicca. This is kind of an obvious one. We all know from personal experience, we see weather changing. We have memories of being a kid or being a young adult. And for some of us, we have memories of being an older adult. We've had different jobs, friends, experiences over the years that have come and gone. It's impermanence. So this is nothing new or surprising. However, as the Buddha taught about suffering and the end of suffering, he talked a lot about impermanence, about anicca. And why is that? Well, for two reasons. One is that we don't always realize the degree that things are changing. And secondly, we often live with a fraught relationship with change. We struggle with change. We want change to happen when things are uncomfortable or annoying, but we don't want change when things are pleasant and nice. So Buddha talked about anicca and that suffering arises when we engage in this kind of struggle. Impermanence is the nature of the conditioned world. Things come into being due to a set of causes and conditions and cease to be when those causes and conditions are no longer present. This is natural. When this, then that. When not this, then not that. This is the way things are. Of course, it's normal that people want a certain degree of stability, perhaps with a little variety just to keep things interesting. But we want to keep that variety pretty much on the pleasant side of things. So we seek out the pleasant bits and try to avoid and get rid of anything that might be unpleasant. Last winter, Sim spent a month talking about the eight worldly winds. a way of framing the types of change. And they come in pairs, complementary pairs, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, status and disgrace. These pairs offer a seductive promise of comfort on the one hand and a threat of discomfort and suffering on the other. The winds of change are not something we have control over or choose between, but rather they're a natural way of how things are. Not good or bad. They are comings and goings, arising and passings, not changing weather. They manifest as sickness, aging, death, as relationships coming and going. Conditions we want and conditions we don't want arise. A natural characteristic of existence. If we insist on things being a certain way, we'll suffer. We can practice with impermanence. In Buddhism, there are 5 daily recollections which support a wise view of impermanence. And the Buddha said, there are these 5 facts that one should reflect on, whether one is a woman or a man, lay or ordained. Which 5? They are, I am of the nature to grow old. I cannot avoid aging. I am the nature to become ill or injured. I cannot avoid illness or injury. I am the nature to die. I cannot avoid death. All that is mine, dear and delightful, will change and vanish. I am the owner of my actions, born of my actions, related to my actions, supported by my actions. Any thoughts, words, or deeds I do, good or evil, those I will inherit. This last one says that we are intimately engaged in the causes and conditions of life, in the flow of change, in the arising and passings, intimately engaged. So it's helpful to be aware of our actions. So all things and events come into being, change, and end. Knowing this experientially, we are less likely to invest our ultimate happiness in impermanent conditions. It's the weather metaphor. Rising and passing of weather, the moving of clouds, the raining, the winds of change. In terms of practice, it's helpful to be mindful of change in our daily lives. Beginnings and endings, comings and goings, arising and passing, entering, leaving, our breath, breathing in, breathing out, days, coming, going, ending, beginning. And all the time, noting, it's like this now. Personally, I like recalling various changes that have occurred in my own life. I look at pictures of my family, of myself, and of my parents over time. I always used to look through that. Still like doing it. Go through a box of photos and see my parents when they were kids. Nice young faces, happy, smiling, beginning their lives. Over time, they had kids. Over time, they got old. Ultimately, they died and passed. Now they're gone for a long time. It's a helpful reflection, seeing change in ourselves and others, becoming aware of impermanence of the fact of life. With mindfulness, we can practice stability in regard to impermanence, steadiness of mind in relationship to changing conditions. Dancers do something called spotting when they go into a spin. On every turn, they focus and they stop their head for a second and focus on a spot. This brings stability. Mindfulness is similar. Typically, change is a bit discombobulating. Now this, now that. Mindfulness provides a steadiness of mind that allows us to relate to ever-changing conditions with greater equanimity, regardless of whether things are pleasant or unpleasant. This mindful spotting allows us to see also with fresh eyes, rather than with an entrenched and unhelpful perspective. We can get a notion about this is how this person is. But we can see them with fresh eyes, with this mindful awareness. With practice, this mindfulness can become more continuous so that we can witness the changingness of life with all its tumultuous comings and goings, and see it with ever more equanimity, like watching scenes in a movie. So our stability in life doesn't come from the ever-changing conditions, but rather stability comes from our view and understanding of the reality of anicca, of impermanence, with a steady mindfulness. The second characteristic is suffering, unsatisfactoriness, dukkha, Pali term. This can be translated as suffering, but it's also helpful to kind of expand that definition a bit, because suffering is a little bit too narrow and harsh. So dukkha includes stressful, unsatisfactory, unreliable. You can't count on it. Buddha said he taught only two things, suffering and the end of suffering, or dukkha and the end of dukkha. And he laid that out in the Four Noble Truths, as you're probably aware. When asked what is suffering, he said, the noble truth of suffering, monks, is this. Birth is suffering. Aging is suffering. Sickness is suffering. Death is suffering. Association with the unpleasant is suffering. Separation from the pleasant is suffering. Not to receive what one wants is suffering. In short, clinging to the five khandhas of suffering. This last phrase means that clinging to a sense of self or impermanent phenomena will lead to suffering, distress, and dukkha. Clinging is the key piece here. Dukkha is the way things are for sentient beings. We feel and respond to our environment. Some things are pleasant, so we move towards them. Some are unpleasant, we retreat. And many things are neither. Like impermanence, dukkha is a basic characteristic of existence. Even amoebas have this natural response. It's a hardwired survival mechanism. We're not wired for happiness, we're wired for survival. And there's a negative bias. So it's best to assume danger in terms of survival. Besides the normal physical conditions of the world, birth, aging, sickness, and death, humans have a rich imagination. We come up with notions of danger and notions of happiness and safety, so we get stuck in traffic jams and come up with ideas. I'm going to be late, and that's going to be really bad. We think if we find a nice partner, a house, and a dog, and other stuff, then I'll be happy. However, considering the impermanent nature of things, this is delusional. So clinging to conditioned things causes suffering. Practicing with dukkha, non-satisfactory, how can we do that? How can we practice with it? First, we can recognize that the experience of stress and suffering is a basic condition of being human. We're not alone. It's a shared experience of humanity. And so, you can say, just like me, others want to be happy. Life's difficulties are not something to be feared or avoided. With an understanding of our connectedness here, we can have compassion for ourselves and all beings can emerge. With mindfulness, we can recognize what conditions are present when we are suffering and not suffering. What's the internal narrative and how is it supporting suffering or not suffering? What is the direct experience that's felt in the body? It can be helpful. Can unhelpful narratives be relaxed or let go of? Our experience with dukkha can be pretty solid and relentless, so finding the spaces between and the moments of light can be helpful in just kind of loosening up and relaxing around our difficulties. As I talk about this, I want to be a little bit careful because I know this can kind of see, okay, kind of glib, and I don't want to imply that you just do this and relating to difficulties is easy. It's not. Life is full of really difficult times, as I imagine we all know. But there can also be ease, And I believe that mindfulness, self-kindness, and patience can be helpful and strong allies as we navigate this territory. The third characteristic is not self or anatta. Of the three, anicca and dukkha make sense to me, at least on a basic level. I can see how things are impermanent and regular experience, day-to-day stress and challenges in life. But understanding anatta is more of a challenge for me. Now, I'm here, you're out there, clearly obvious. I have memories, pictures of myself over the years. People respond when I call their name. I respond when they call mine. And while my body has changed, my basic sense of self seems pretty substantial and persistent. But I trust the Buddha's teaching. And he points to this. I have confidence in his teachings. However, I'm not just going to believe it as an act of faith. I want to arrive at an understanding through my own experience, reflection, and investigation. The Buddha was asked by somebody, is there a self? He didn't answer. Yes, the guy asked again, is there not a self? Still no answer. The person's left frustrated and left. The disciple asked, why didn't you answer him? To which the Buddha said, either affirming or denying a self would have been misleading. So I find this to be helpful. So not self or anatta is neither a denial nor an annihilation of self. As I've tried to gain an understanding of not self over the years, a number of things have been helpful for me. First, understanding doesn't arise as a result of figuring it out. It also helpful to know that not self or anatta or anatta, for both pronunciations, is neither a denial nor an annihilation of self, but rather more of a process of thinning the self, as Rodney Smith says. That is, loosening the grip of identification with a permanent, independent self. For me, this loosening has happened through science, personal reflections, and seeing ways I identify with views and opinions, possessions, and images of myself and others. I consider how interconnected and interdependent I am, reflecting on all the plants, animals, and people who have made it possible for me to have food, shelter, clothing, medical care. And not to forget the couple of pounds of microorganisms living in me and supporting my life. You know that? There's a couple of pounds of other living things, other beings inside of us that are keeping themselves alive and themselves alive. I also like to think about how small this planet is within the cosmos, how short of time humans have been around in the history of the universe. These types of reflections support a loosening of the sense of an independent self-directing organism. Psychologically speaking, it's important to have a healthy sense of self. Insisting or claiming I have no self would be clinging to the notion of that concept and would also lead to suffering. So, in terms of practicing with not self, it's helpful to see how clinging to our sense of self causes suffering for ourselves and others. Identification with this is me, about me, taking things personally, needing to defend ourselves, wanting to be seen as kind and generous, don't want to be seen as greedy or angry or stupid. I should be this way, don't want to be that way. So we can cling to views and opinions. I'm right, they're wrong, suffering. Not a very helpful approach in relationship. Likewise, it's helpful to notice how we feel when we don't identify with ourselves. Consider a grandmother caring for a crying baby. That open-heartedness that she is expressing. Consider how we feel when we get a gift or help a friend with no expectation or thoughts about ourselves. Just giving. Not about me. Our thoughts define us, yet our thoughts are not who we are. We can see how the sense of ourselves is determined by our thoughts. Thoughts that aren't true are contradictory, changing. When we believe them and act out of them, we cause ourselves and others a great deal of distress. I'm not good enough, I'm shy, too old, not very smart, I'll never be happy. My parents neglected me, what can I expect? As we see those thoughts, it can be helpful to ask, is this true? This identification of these narratives true? Are they helpful? Really? I want to end tonight with a story about, maybe some of you have read the book Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson. Brian Stevenson is a lawyer who has dedicated his life to helping people get off of, who are committed to the death sentence down south, and he helps get them off. And he talks about one client he had, Avery Jenkins, who was an African-American man with serious mental deficiencies and a history of serious and physical and mental abuse in foster care. So he's on death row for this brutal stabbing, murder, while he was experiencing a psychotic episode. His whole childhood history and mental capacities had not been taken into consideration during the trial and sentences. So in his meeting with Brian Stevenson, he was more interested in having a chocolate milkshake than in his current plight. Well, on the way in to see Avery, Brian sees this red pickup truck outside in front of the jail, and it's plastered with racist bumper stickers, Confederate flags, a gun rack, just a hateful moving vehicle. When he enters the building, he realizes the guard who greets him is the owner of that vehicle. And the guard, rather than giving a routine pat down that an attorney would normally expect, the guard insisted on doing a full strip body search and made a point of saying that that's his red truck out there and, you know, kind of bullying Brian. Well, Brian could have fought. He could have, you know, argued. He could have, you know, done something and said, wait a minute, I'm a lawyer. But he didn't. He sucked it up and went in and realized his priority is getting this man off of death row. Months later, there was a pre-trial hearing for Avery. Brian went there, and he sees this red truck parked outside the courthouse. Apparently, the same guard was the one who transported Avery to the court. Over 3 days, Brian Stevenson presented evidence about Avery's history and mental condition, the abuse he had during his foster care. A horrible experience. Nothing happened at that hearing, but a month after the hearing, as they're waiting for the results, the court results, Brian went back to visit Avery in jail, and again, he sees the same truck parked outside. So now he braces for another encounter with the guard. But this time he was surprised. The guard came up to him and said, shook his hand, said, thank you. I saw you defending that man in court. I was a foster kid. I have anger, often wonder why. You help me understand. Thank you. I appreciate that story. It points to me what happens when we identify and create separation. What happens when we bridge our differences and connect. Thank you.